Forces PFPS.
The Forces Station.
BFPS. Original Forces Programs. Sunrise. It's a warm, early summer's day. In a world torn apart by almost 6 years of death, destruction, mass murder, genocide. Over 2,076 days, tens of millions have lost their lives to a seemingly unstoppable axis of evil. Unstoppable to all, but those who are determined to fight the tyranny this unequaled enemy stands for. But on this new day, new hope emerges. Hope of survival. Rebirth. From the clutches of war. It is a day for victory. May the 8th, 1945. 11 months after the events of D-Day.
We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be.
The war in Europe was over. These are the voices that the world heard in the final months of the war. The voices of soldiers, sailors, airmen.
I'll do my celebrating when I hear Germany has surrendered.
30,000 people crowded into one space, cheering him and cheering.
Politicians and military leaders.
On this day of victory in Europe, I would ask you all to remember those of our comrades who fell in the struggle.
These original archive recordings from September 1944 to May 1945 tell the very real story of the climactic days of the war's most horrific ever conflict. This is VE Day 75, Sound Stories. Sound Stories. How do you follow the largest invasion in history? On Tuesday, June the 6th, 1944, the Allied armies carried out a series of monumental landings on the beaches of northern France. The event marked the beginning of the end of World War II. But the next steps would prove to be harder. The Allies had their sights set on not only France, but Belgium, the Netherlands, and ultimately, they needed to take Germany. By September 1945, Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery's forces, alongside the US force, were starting, slowly, to make progress.
The Allies have removed the enemy from practically the whole of France and Belgium, except in a few places, and we stand at the door of Germany. The enemy has suffered immense losses in men and material. It is becoming problematical how much longer he can continue the struggle. Such a historic march of events can seldom have taken place in history in such a short space of time.
This is the BBC Home Service. And before we go on to the next part of the program, here's another piece of good news. The Allies have now crossed the Dutch frontier. The announcement has been made by the Netherlands Prime Minister in a broadcast to his countrymen.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is the news read by Stuart Hibbert. American troops are reported to have entered the city of Luxembourg. Others beyond Liège are within 10 miles of Aachen in Germany. And to the northwest, they have...
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is a special announcement. Reports have come in from British Second Army headquarters this morning with the good news that we are in Brussels. Our armored cars reached the capital yesterday afternoon, and British troops have been given a great welcome from our Belgian ally.
The march across Europe towards victory was never going to be an easy one for the Allied forces. As the world awaited news of every small step towards defeating the enemy, the next step, as reported by the BBC, was about to be made.
About 2 hours ago, Supreme Headquarters gave the news of our airborne landing in Holland in this brief announcement. Strong forces of the 1st Allied Airborne Army were landed in Holland this afternoon. The Germans say that landings were made by paratroops followed by gliders at three places in the southern part of Holland. Before the airborne landings, something like 1,000 escorted flying fortresses bombed German gun positions in Holland this morning, and the country's airfields had been pounded by Bomber Command Lancasters during the night. Many people in England watched our terrific air fleets on their way to Holland with gliders in tow, a good sight on the Sunday that commemorates the Battle of Britain 4 years ago. It's the first operation since the British and American airborne forces were combined in one command last month.
This was Operation Market Garden.
We've been flying straight into Holland now for something like 20 minutes. So far, without any opposition, at least none that I have been able to see.
There goes, you hear him shout? 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15.
Nearly 70,000 Allied troops took part, but Operation Market Garden failed to secure the key bridge at Arnhem, and the planned invasion of Germany had to be delayed.
As everybody knows by now, the task of the 1st Airborne Division was to capture and hold the bridge at Arnhem and establish a firm bridgehead round the town so that the 2nd Army, with its armour, would have a clear passage northwards from Nijmegen over the River Lek. You may know that an airborne division is not built to fight by itself for more than a limited period. We had hoped to join up the 2nd Army 3 to 4 days at the latest, and as things worked out, we were by ourselves for 9 days.
About 5 kilometers to the west of Arnhem, in a space 1,500 yards by 900 on that last day, I saw the dead and the living. Those who fought a good fight and kept the faith with you at home, and those who still fought magnificently on. I last saw them yesterday morning as they dribbled into Nijmegen. Everyone wondered what the final checkup would amount to. I walked up to one young lieutenant to ask him about his sergeant, and he started to explain what had happened and then turned away. Remember, all of these men had been practically 10 days and 10 nights under the most murderous concentrated fire I've seen in 2 wars. Then he turned again and said, "It's hell to be pulled out when you haven't finished your job, isn't it?"
Victory in Europe would have to wait a while longer. If war was hard, the winter of 1944-45 made it even harder. After the failure of Operation Market Garden, Montgomery, whose leadership was partially blamed, was keen to rebuild morale and continue the journey to victory.
The forces of the British Empire in Western Europe spend Christmas 1944 in the field. But what a change has come over the scene since last Christmas. The supreme battle of Normandy carried with it the liberation of France and Belgium. It would have needed a brave man to say on D-Day, the 6th of June, that in 6 months we would be fighting in Germany, having driven the enemy back across his own frontiers.
Hello, BBC. This is a dispatch from Ian Wilson in France. Here is the story of the Battle of Bastogne and of its gallant and successful defense by the men of the 101st Airborne Division. This division jumped into action in Normandy and Holland, but when the Germans recently broke through in the Ardennes, the airborne men went into battle for the first time in trucks. Brigadier General A.C. McCauley, deputy commander of the 101st Airborne Division and commander of Bastogne.
For the first 3 days, we gave the Germans a licking of their lives. On the 3rd day, the German commander had the effrontery to send us a surrender demand. When we got it, we thought it was the funniest thing we ever heard. I just laughed and said, "Nuts." But the German major who brought it wanted a formal answer. So I decided, I'd just say nuts. So I had it written out. Quote, to the German commander, "Nuts." Signed, the American commander.
Meanwhile in Holland, German V-2 rockets were being targeted by Spitfires in Operation Big Ben.
Our own squadron was lucky enough to be the first to attack the V-2 sites in Holland. We operate from dawn till dusk, each squadron flying as many as 3 trips a day, and we've got to fly out from this country every time. The worst moment is on the dive itself, when everything seems to be concentrated on you. Then the bombs go, the whole plane becomes lighter and freer, and then you pull out and swing away as quickly as possible. You must remember that the target is pretty small, and your bombing must therefore be very accurate. Then when you've done your bombing, you begin your patrol until the next squadron arrives to take over. All this may not sound very spectacular, but I can assure you that we're doing a good deal of damage.
Wherever you may be, fighting in the front line, I wish all of you good luck and a happy 1945. We are all one great team. Together, you and I, we have achieved much. And together, we will see the thing through to the end. Good luck for you all.
War is messy. The Second World War claimed the lives of up to 85 million people. As the Allies moved closer to Germany, they unleashed bombing raids that devastated parts of the countryside and major cities. On March the 5th, 1945, US correspondent Stuart McPherson described the great devastation of Cologne by Allied bombers and ground fighting.
I have just came out of the battered and bruised corpse that was once the living city of Cologne. I was able to get into a point well past the park system, that is near the sports palace. But even there, a mile or so from the heart of what used to be Cologne, one could see the desert of waste and rubble that was once romantic Cologne. Here and there, even in the suburbs of the German city, shreds of buildings cling desperately to a sprawling skeleton of streets. When we went in this morning with American infantry, you could see the bunkers, the basements, and the cellars that have been the living quarters for those still inhabiting the city. In several of the outlying towns, we passed German civilians in the cold rain, pushing bicycles, push carts, anything with wheels, all packed to the roof with their personal belongings. Late last night, I went forward to a forward command post, and on the road, our dim lights of our jeep picked up women and children and men, all on the roads moving back from Cologne.
Reporting for the BBC, correspondent Robert Reed took out his bulky recorder to describe to the British public the devastation of German towns, villages, and countryside.
In attempting to defend their countryside, the German army asked for trouble and got it. A dread visitation which has blanketed hundreds of miles of a prosperous, fertile agricultural land with overwhelming disaster. You feel it in your very bones as you motor up to our advanced positions. An air of depression and hopelessness seems to charge the very atmosphere. There are scores of German villages, while many of those villages will never appear again in the same form. They are no longer human habitations, but mere stone husks, often blackened and burnt out from end to end, the result of our artillery and air force answer to Hitler's boast that he would defend every town and village and house between here and the Rhine. Between here and the Rhine.
Between here and the Rhine. Victory in Europe in World War II meant everything. But to achieve it, a massive military effort made up of tens of thousands of Allied forces needed to do something we take for granted today. Cross a river. It's March the 8th, 1945, and this is how the news broke on the BBC.
The Allies are across the Rhine. Troops under General Hodges established a bridgehead on the east bank south of Bonn yesterday afternoon. The west bank of the Rhine between Cologne and Bonn has all been almost cleared, and First Army troops are in Bonn itself. British forces have entered Xanten. Nearly 3,000 Allied planes have attacked targets in Germany.
I'm up forward with the crew, and behind me are our one-way passengers. 17 United States paratroopers, including a general whose name I must withhold, this short time is going to jump with his men across the Rhine into the Ruhr. We're getting up near the battle area now. Green light, there they go. One, two, good luck, boys. There goes the general. They've jumped right down into Germany and already they're almost out of sight.
The battle order, the schedule of operations for this great airborne landing in Germany, took up a score of pages of typewritten foolscap with appendices and charts and timetables and map. By reading it, you could see how immensely complicated is such an operation. In fact, how great a triumph today has been for Allied planning and execution. The army was on the move into Germany.
Now we're moving out of our position on the flank of the runway and into the middle of the track, taking up the strain on our tow rope. The engines are being revved up their full peak, and we are off. Forward down the runway, gathering speed quite steadily. I'm holding on my grip death now. We're bumping slightly down the runway. The navigator's holding the throttle wide open. Down we go, gathering speed, heavier and heavier, faster and faster. Now we're beginning to lift slightly. And we're off. We're off the ground. We're climbing gently into the air. The glider riding steadily behind us. following in the line of aircraft and gliders that I can see wheeling away to starboard ahead of us. We are in the air and we are on the way.
As the Allies crossed the River Rhine, as they fought their way further into Germany, they started to feel that victory was coming.
Troops of the American First Army crossed the Rhine south of Cologne at 4:30 yesterday afternoon. This triumphant news was given us late this evening by Frank Gillard, our correspondent with General Bradley's 12th Army Group. A Reuters report from the 1st American Army says that the crossing was made at Remagen, which is about 25 miles south of Cologne between Bonn and Koblenz. Few other details are known yet, but all reports say that the crossing was made against only weak opposition, and the 1st Army's bridgehead on the east bank was described tonight as being firm.
Sitting beside a runway in Lincolnshire on April the 25th, 1945, this reporter was about to witness a secret yet important blow to Hitler's reign of terror across Europe. The Lancaster bombers of 9 Squadron and 617 Squadron set off to deliver a deadly surprise to Adolf Hitler's beloved mountain retreat in Bavaria.
Hello, BBC. This is Brian Bliss with Bomber Command. It's 0 hour. The attack is on. And the first Lancaster swinging into position at the head of the runway right opposite me now. Here she comes. Remember, this is the squadron which sank the Tirpitz, and now they're off for Berchtesgaden with 12,000 pounders. And there she goes! The marvelous sight as she races by!
Soon after 8, we reached the Bavarian Alps, and everyone did a final check on their equipment. There were to be no mistakes on this attack. As the leader of my formation, I was not able to observe immediate results. But as we turned for home, the entire target area was covered by smoke, with the biggest cloud of all draped over the Hitler hideout.
But as the Allies tasted victory, they were about to be dealt a tragic blow as a much-loved leader and a key figure in the March of Freedom died.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here's the first news for today, Friday the 13th of April, read by Frederick Allen. President Roosevelt, we sincerely regret to announce, died suddenly last night. The tragic news reached this country just before midnight. Mr. Roosevelt died at his cottage at Warm Springs, Georgia, at 10:30 from cerebral hemorrhage. As soon as the news was received in London, the King was informed. His Majesty was deeply shocked and expressed his most profound and sincere regret. The news was also given immediately to Mr. Churchill, to whom it came as a complete surprise and great personal shock. When an American president dies in office, he's succeeded by the Vice President, and Mr. Harry Truman was therefore sworn in a few hours ago as the 33rd President of the United States.
It was a total war. It wasn't just military targets in the firing line. Both sides had targeted towns, cities even, with devastating results. Just as it seemed the horrors might be almost over, the BBC's Richard Dimbleby filed an astonishing and horrifying report from a place in Germany called Belsen. It was April the 19th, 1945, when much of Britain and the world heard for the first time what horror really was.
Here, over an acre of ground, lay dead and dying people. You could not see which was which, except perhaps by a convulsive movement or the last quiver of a sigh from a living skeleton too weak to move. The living lay with their heads against the corpses, and around them moved the awful ghostly procession of emaciated, aimless people, with nothing to do and no hope of life. Unable to move out of your way, unable to look at the terrible sights around them. There was no privacy, nor did men or women ask it any longer. Women stood and squatted, stark naked in the dust, trying to wash themselves and to catch the lice on their bodies. Babies had been born here, tiny, wizened things that could not live. A mother, driven mad, screamed at a British sentry to give her milk for her child, and thrust the tiny mite into his arms and ran off, crying terribly. He opened the bundle and found the baby had been dead for days. This day at Belsen was the most horrible of my life.
In under 10 years, a tiny political movement had taken over a country, then threatened much of the world. Germany's political masters, the Nazis, had been obsessed with domination, but as their plans to create a new world order slowly started crumbling, the Allies saw an end in sight to the struggle to retake Europe. 6 days before the ultimate victory came.
We are into the center of the city of Bremen. If you can call this chaotic rubbish heap, in which our bulldozers are working as I speak, their men with handkerchiefs around their throat to avoid the flying dust, if you can call this rubbish heap a city anymore. When we came in this morning, we had a look at our city maps, but there's no shape and no order, and certainly no hope for this shell of a city that was once called Bremen. It's the sheer size of the smashed area that overwhelms you. These endless vistas down small streets with the houses leaning at drunken angles, and this inhuman landscape of great blocks of flats with their sides ripped open, and the intimate household goods just spilled out into the bomb craters. We rather expected it when we came in, but again, it's the scale that counts. Bremen, by the look of it, was a city of about, say, 300,000 inhabitants. But once you're past the outer suburbs, there's hardly a house intact in which these people could live. Of course, they haven't even tried to live in them. Everybody has gone into those giant air raid shelters, these great blocks of almost solid concrete that are dotted all over the ruins of Bremen. They've stood up to the bombing well, and now from the one opposite us, the people are coming out to stare at the tanks and the bulldozers and at the guns now rolling past us into the heart of the city. Some of these people are already starting to potter about in that seemingly aimless way that bombed out people do, among the dusty rubble. They're pulling out odd bits of furniture, just something to patch up the few rooms and the ground floor that have occasionally remained intact in these ruined streets. And overall, there's an almost summer sun blazing down on this tumbled desert of brick and rubble that once was Bremen.
The BBC's Stuart Hibbard interrupted regular BBC programs to report a piece of news that much of the world had been waiting for. The fall of Berlin.
Now we're breaking into our programs for the second time tonight, this time with some splendid news from Moscow. Berlin has fallen. Marshal Stalin has just announced the complete capture of the capital of Germany, the center of German imperialism, and the cradle of German aggression. Berlin garrison laid down their arms this afternoon. More than 70,000 prisoners have been rounded up so far today.
Today, many Soviet flags are flying in Berlin, notably on the Reichstag building, where the Red Army's banner of victory was hoisted yesterday afternoon. Other Soviet troops have also driven almost to the center of the city from the east. The German High Command communique, still issued nominally from Hitler's headquarters, opened this afternoon with these words: "In the heart of Berlin, the gallant garrison, closely gathered around the Führer, is defending itself in a reduced space against the superior Bolsheviks." That's the first time during the crisis, and probably the first time ever, that the Nazis have put Hitler into one of his own communiques.
This is London calling. Here is a news flash. The German radio has just announced that Hitler is dead. I repeat that. The German radio has just announced that Hitler is dead.
Hello, BBC. This is Winford Vaughan Thomas reporting to you from Germany. When I heard the news of Hitler's death, I went out and I talked to the British Tommies. What were your first feelings about it, Private Townsend? They announced that Hitler died with his troops defending his chancellery. Is that the way you wanted him to die?
No, we all feel cheated about it. We'd rather him see him die like a common murderer. I think he got off light.
Do you think this means the end of the war?
Well, Hitler is dead, yes. I'll do my celebrating when I hear Germany has surrendered.
Adolf Hitler died on April the 30th, 1945. It was his successor, Karl Dönitz, who finally surrendered to the Allies on June 8th. Reporter Winford Vaughan Thomas described the mass surrender of German troops to British forces just east of the city of Hamburg.
I'm standing in the little village of Lauenburg, and I'm watching the sight that we'd hoped we'd see. It's for
for 6 long years, the German army coming into surrender into the British lines. Since 2 o'clock this morning, this endless stream of transport has been pouring through this town under the white flags hung over the shattered houses by the inhabitants, who are standing in the streets looking dumbfounded at this wreckage of the Wehrmacht that's going past us. These people are defeated soldiers. You can see it in their eyes. And what do the British soldiers who've been watching it think about it?
Well, sir, we've been waiting 6 long years for this. What a sight. My boy, I'd never seen nothing like it.
It began on a warm autumn day in the closing months of the 1930s. It ended 2,076 days later, after the deaths of 3% of the world's population, 85 million lives lost in the fight for freedom. V-Day marked the end of conflict, and for many, the rebirth of hope. Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery.
On this day of victory in Europe, I would ask you all to remember those of our comrades who fell in the struggle. They gave their lives that others might have freedom, and no man can do more than that. Let us embark on what lies ahead, full of joy and optimism. We have won the German war. Let us now win the peace. Good luck to you all, wherever you may be.
King George VI.
Today, we give thanks to God for a great deliverance. Speaking from our empire's oldest capital city, war battered, but never for one moment daunted or dismayed. Germany, the enemy who drove all Europe into war, has been finally overcome. In the Far East, we have yet to deal with the Japanese, a determined and cruel foe. Queen and I know the ordeals which you have endured. We are proud to have shared some of them with you.
Now just listen. All Whitehall, from the Cenotaph to the House of Commons, is one sea of waving hands and handkerchiefs. 30,000 people crowded into one space, cheering him and cheering.
Prime Minister Winston Churchill.
Yesterday morning at 2:41 a.m. at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl, the representative of the German High Command, and of Grand Admiral Dönitz, the designated head of the German state, signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe to the Allied expeditionary forces. But let us not forget for a moment the toils and efforts that lie ahead. Japan, with all her treachery and greed, remains unsubdued. The injuries she has inflicted upon Great Britain, the United States and other countries, and her detestable cruelties call for justice and retribution. We must now devote all our strength and resources to the completion of our tasks, both at home and abroad. Advance Britannia! Long live the cause of freedom! God save the King.
God save the King.
Today is victory in Europe Day.
VE Day 75, Sound Stories, is an original forces program for BFBS. It was narrated by Mark Chadwick and written and produced by Andrew Wright. This program is a tribute to all who endured the pain of global war, resisted an overwhelming enemy. We remember all those who stood up and fought for our freedom.